From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for September 24th, 2021. Lots of fun stuff happening this weekend, like Harvest Fest at State Fair. Your playoff-bound Milwaukee Brewers host the New York Mets and the Packers. They're in San Francisco Sunday night with the 49ers. Okay, at 101, Virginia Oliver from Maine goes lobster fishing in the Atlantic Ocean 3 days a week, 7 months a year, and that's her job. That's right, she's still working at 101 and doesn't have a retirement plan. Now, Virginia, if you're listening, you could call us here at Landis & Company at 223-1099. We might have been able to set you up with lobster swimming in butter every night of the week, or not. Sam Adams, the brewery, has created a new beer, and it's illegal in 28 states, but of course not Wisconsin. Spirits like vodka and tequila run about 40% alcohol by volume. Most beers are 5 to 8% alcohol, but the new Sam Adams beer is 28% alcohol. Oh, mama, that's not a light beer. A man in Florida is charged with multiple felonies for exposing himself to toll booth collectors. One of the charges is salacious intent. Why? Because he chose not to use the exact change lane. Here's a circular conversation. Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, said employees that leak memos do not belong at Apple. That's according to a leaked memo. And our goofy headline of the week is from Oklahoma. Homeless man under house arrest. On the podcast today, we have Brian Kilb, Chris Evers, Mike Heltzel, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max, and good to hear Oklahoma pitching in this week. It's not just Florida.
We had Florida.
Overall, a good week for the markets, although started pretty rough on Monday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average finished the week up 0.6%, closing at 34,798. The S&P 500 up 0.5%, closing at 44,56. And the NASDAQ essentially flat for the week, closed at 15,048. For the year, the NASDAQ now up 17.3%, including dividends. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 15.3%, and the S&P 500 up 19.9%, including dividends. You know, Brian, I think as we look at the start of this week, it's incredible. Early Monday morning, we have a meeting around this same table that we record this podcast at, and we were looking at a market that was down already about 1.5% or 2% Monday morning. And I think the focus of my conversation was, you know, it just feels like this is the type of environment where, absent some good news, we're just not going to get a quick recovery here, that stocks are going to be allowed to drift around at some of these lower levels. We challenged some technical indicators this week. But all of a sudden, Tuesday morning, really without any, you know, major headline pointing back the other direction, markets recover. We get, again, a pretty decent week overall after what had been two pretty rough weeks. What's your takeaway, I guess, from you know, kind of that abrupt shift from a pretty significant down Monday to gaining it all back the next couple of days?
You know, Kyle, you and I've talked a lot. There's a sense, I think, for me anyway, that I wouldn't be surprised if we had a pullback, right? Not that I anticipate one necessarily. There's a lot of money supporting the markets. There's a lot of other factors that could make that, could allow that not to happen. But on Monday, we're like shaking our heads thinking maybe this is kind of something that we were anticipating. And then, you know, lo and behold, a few days later, here we are and we're back to where we were. And I think it speaks rather to the strength of kind of a momentum market, you know. And we've been through a few momentum markets over the years, and it's hard to predict, you know. When there's a lot of buying, there's a lot of support, there's an attitude of optimism. We've gotten through some pretty severe challenges over the last couple of years and stayed on the optimistic side of the market. So you think, you know, on the other end maybe of the recovery now, and having posted some pretty good news over the last few months and looking ahead and not being as fearful of some things as we might. I mean, my gosh, we're looking at interest rate rise, you know, tight interest rate it's going up next year and some tightening, and even that isn't shaking the market. So plenty of things, I think, plenty of reasons to think that we might have had a sustained pullback, but it hadn't happened. There's just a lot of momentum out there right now. And quite frankly, I don't know what, if anything, will break that in the short run. Hard to say.
Yeah, and I think important to remember that a couple of days doesn't make a streak, right? That we shouldn't take much from the 3 or 4 days that have been positive this week, just like we probably shouldn't have taken much from the 8 or 9 days the prior 2 weeks that were pretty significantly down. And so I think, you know, you try not to extrapolate too much from these short periods of time, and yet, I think safe to say that a lot of the concerns that brought the markets down a week, 2 weeks ago, still out there. In particular, one of the ones we talked about, Chris, the Evergrande and the potential for default on this Chinese real estate firm. As of end of day Thursday, they missed an $83.5 million payment, interest payment on $2 billion worth of U.S. dollar-denominated bonds. That's a pretty big number that's now at risk. And so as we kind of look at some of the concerns there, what kinds of things stand out to you as we look at, the potential for what could be a pretty meaningful default in a Chinese property firm?
Yeah, Kyle, the Evergrande story's probably been top of the paper for much of this week, even though it's been something that, if you've paid attention to the company itself, it's been poorly rated debt for a while. So this isn't a situation where, an investment grade company out of nowhere, is close to declaring bankruptcy. I think, and what we pointed out a couple weeks ago, and I believe even last week on the show, is Evergrande's not quite as closely connected to a lot of U.S. firms or international banks. That's probably where your biggest concern would have been, if Evergrande were to default and there was a lot of U.S. banks or European banks that held their debt. The concern is, okay, now those banks are in, hardship because they're not receiving the payment and lost out on a lot of assets. That doesn't seem to be the case. The bigger concern right now is probably just, is this going to become a slowdown for China in general as the property sector has to absorb this? There's a lot of people that purchased apartments and condos from Evergrande and gave them money. And, frankly, the buildings haven't been completed yet. And they're looking for their money back. And, that's probably the most likely place to have concern right now is just, what does that mean for the Chinese consumer and what happens to their global growth? Obviously, everybody's got an eye on the Chinese Communist Party and how they're going to respond to this and how much stress they'll let the market, withstand on its own.
What I think is so interesting is we all now are taking stock of who's got Evergrande debt. We're all taking stock of even some other Chinese real estate firms that might be of concern. We're taking stock of who owes who money. And I think it's, for many reminiscent of the financial crisis. I think the difference here is we've been way far ahead of the risk here, whereas in the financial crisis, we really spent the first 6 or 9 months just playing catch up, right? Just trying to figure out where the risk really was. That seems to be less of the issue here. And so, there is this risk that it's a broader economic problem and not exclusive to this particular business. But I think, as we talk about what the risks really are, it's less about counterparty risk like it was during the financial crisis. And it's more about the impact of, I think, what a slowing Chinese economy might have on the world at large.
There's kind of a more subtle issue at play, too, that I actually think is kind of a positive in that, going back to the financial crisis, we kind of every time somebody had a problem, it seems, we've kind of propped them up in one way or the other. Now, over there, it's the Communist Party just deciding to do whatever they decide to do. Over here, it might be monetary policy, it might be fiscal policy, it might be the government actually just stepping in and saving somebody. So I kind of like the fact that they're going to let some potentially bad debt go bad because it recalibrates risk back into the system. Because if every time something's going to go afoul, somebody steps in and makes the problem go away, kind of messes with the whole idea of risk and free markets and whatnot. So I think that, and as that may trail into a conversation about what's happening with more stimulus in this country and more spending and some of the troubles they're having executing on that front and getting a deal done, I think, for me anyway, that's kind of somewhat encouraging too, because I don't need to go from $28 trillion in debt to 30. So, kind of a different take on things, but I think all in all, good to see that maybe there is some sensitivity to debt in a global fashion.
Yeah, I think such an interesting point, Brian. We've used the term too big to fail far too often. I think that there are some reasons why you might want some of this stuff to fail, because I think it makes investors appropriately measure risk, appropriately accept payment for risk. And we really haven't seen that in markets for a while. It's why we've said on this podcast for a number of times that if you're buying bonds, and the reason you're buying bonds is for protection in your account, you should be paying attention to the risk you're taking, because at some point in time, someone's going to go, you know what, it's not worth bailing this company out. And so I think, you know, we haven't been getting paid to take the kind of risks we're seeing now. And hopefully this lets investors take stock of the risk that's really out there.
You know, I saw earlier in the day that our allocation to stocks, our being the U.S. public, is as high as it's been in a long time, and which is typically not a good indicator for future performance in stocks. And again, what that has to do with anything, I don't know. But I do think it's kind of that, you know, if we sat here and talked about some of the potential negatives, which we should do, right, to keep on both sides of the fence and keep, yeah, people are leaning pretty hard into risk right now. And you know, the way that gets reset is to have a little pain and suffering along the way. And so maybe this whole thing with Evergrande is just a little bit of a commercial for, hey, be careful, because and know what you got, you know.
Yeah, great point. You know, Brian, you had mentioned earlier the Fed. Mike, I know it's a conversation you've had quite a bit this week. We had a Fed meeting. Fed released some notes and I think some pretty interesting projections about the path forward. But in particular, a couple of things on the Fed's mind, the idea of tapering some of their bond buying, tapering the asset portfolio that they have, but also some interest rate hikes potentially on tap.
Yeah, so they Chairman Powell came out basically and said that they're going to probably start stop their tapering or slow it down around December-ish, which reports say that's going to be about $15 billion a month. So that should pretty much stop that around July or August. I don't know. I'm not great with numbers. You guys can check my math at that point in time.
Good to hear, Mike.
I only do this for a living. But the other thing you brought up is the rate hikes. For a while there, we heard that they weren't going to raise rates until 2023. Now there's a chance that you could see one or two rate hikes next year, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, because even if they follow, you know, previous patterns, it could be a quarter point each raise. So if you even have two next year, you're still under 1%, which is still very low. So that still bodes well for markets. And I think what investors can appreciate from the chairman's comments is just how he's telegraphing everything, right? He's not looking to make any surprises, make any waves. And so I think when he reports things like that, that stuff's going to be, to use a phrase that Bob always uses, baked into the cake. That's going to be baked in the cake pretty early for markets, and so they can digest it properly, so you're not going to have any surprises or shockwaves like you might if they were just to spring a rate hike on you.
Yeah, I think the surprise is always how forecasts change and how the expectations change from meeting to meeting, because while we hear things from Fed governors and Fed members in between those meetings, it really is those official statements we tend to look to, and some, I think, meaningful shifts in some of the outlook, in particular some of the inflationary measures. Brian, I know it's a conversation you and I have pretty regularly, but they're seeing the potential for a little bit higher inflation on tap than maybe what they'd been saying before.
Yeah, I mean, if you kind of fast forward around the corner past increases and tightening and whatnot, well, first of all, I mean, the market's barely reacted to that, which I think speaks to the Fed's openness and clarity in terms of, you know, not surprising people. But if you think about it, I mean, we've had easy money back to the financial crisis, and we're turning a corner on that, and the market's still, hey, no big deal so far, you know. So I think that implies that people still think in the long term that interest rates won't rise appreciably, right? They'll rise a little bit, maybe get back to some decent level, but won't go beyond that and cause problems. You know, which kind of gets to the whole conversation of inflation. Right now you're like, well, is inflation transitory or not? Well, first of all, I think I'm confused what transitory is, because I thought they were talking about fall, and now, you know, it looks like we're going to settle, you know, we're going to deal with a little bit higher inflation probably through middle or, latter part of next year, which I guess that's transitory. I don't know. But I think, you know, I'm going to continue to be a bit wary about whether inflation is going to go away in a meaningful way or whether it remains in a meaningful way. And I think it speaks to supply chain problems. I think it speaks more to the labor shortage which is causing a lot of the supply chain problems, you know. And I think kids are back in school. People are going to go to work. Some of the support payments have ended. People are going to go back to work. So I think it'll be interesting over the next few months to see where that all settles, and how much of enduring problems there really are in terms of building stuff, you know, because you can't buy it if they don't build it. So I think it'll be interesting to see where we end up there.
I think what I appreciate most about that conversation is, you know, we clearly have seen meaningful bouts of inflation, but it's been so unique in where it shows up. And sometimes it's a supply issue. Sometimes it's a supply and demand issue. And so I think, you know, as the Fed has said, it's transitory. It's, well, those things tend to work themselves out in time. But I think the reality is there's some areas of the market where we're just going to have to settle for some of those higher prices, whether it's gasoline settling in at a little bit higher price than maybe where we were pre-pandemic, whether it's, you know, the dollars you're spending at the grocery store, right? You used to spend $120 every time you walked into the store, and now it's $125. Well, yeah, maybe that doesn't sound like all that big of an increase, but it is an increase. And if you're shopping 3-4 times a month, you know, that money starts to add up. And so I think important for us to watch it. The reverse of that, of course, is what we do about it. And I think what's so unique is that even if inflation is a little bit higher than what we thought it would be, it probably doesn't drastically change how we construct portfolios. It probably doesn't drastically change where the opportunities are. It's really when we start to get very high inflation and an absence of economic growth that you'd really get worried about what's going to happen next. And so I think the key is, of course, that as long as we're having some bouts of inflation, whether it's transitory through fall or whether it's transitory through sometime next year or later, you want to have a little bit of economic growth to accompany it.
Yeah, you know, I hate to use like a single anecdote to make a point because then, you know, you're always at risk of distorting things. But I ordered a Ford Bronco back in January. So now I think about this for a minute. I talked to them today, and they're thinking maybe the second half of next year. Now, I'm 63 years old. Like, I don't know whenever in my life that I didn't walk into a showroom and buy a car. Now, maybe they had to ship it from Chicago or Fond du Lac or whatever because they didn't have the right color or some silly thing. Who knows? But a year and a half, you know, to get it. And I think that again, I'm not saying that's the case across, you know, the broad sectors of the economy and everything. But I think it is a telling story. And I think come spring, maybe, you know, we'll have a better perspective on whether this is, you know, we don't care if it's a year. You know, I don't care if it's 6 months or a year and a half. I do care how bad the number is and how long it's bad. And I think it's way too early to start thinking about that. But it's not too early to be aware of it and to pay attention to it and to not dismiss it as a potential problem.
Brian, I have a question for you. Is it a white Ford Bronco?
No.
It's such a cheap joke. I had to take it.
Yeah, no.
Well, once they get those roof issues figured out with those Broncos, I'm sure yours will be on the production.
Well, that's a funny point, though, too, Kyle, because it's not the chip, right? It's not the chip. It's a completely different, unrelated problem to what's the norm in the auto industry right now. So kind of funny.
But, well, and I think that's part of the story, right, is that it isn't just one problem. There's problems coming from all over the place, whether it's ships waiting outside the harbor to get in to unload or whether it's that you just can't keep up with production. There's plenty of bottlenecks right now that need to be resolved.
Well, and how about people telling you to order your Christmas presents now so that you're sure you can get them? Well, that front end loads the demand side as well, you know. So now you're creating more bottlenecks by anticipating the bottlenecks, you know, and that is kind of inflationary. So we'll see where it all goes, but it's fascinating, I think.
Yeah, normally Bob's not asking Max about his 7-Eleven visits until far closer to Christmas Day. So
you're gonna have to go 2 weeks in advance this year, Max.
Might have to start thinking about that around Thanksgiving.
or just cash, like just give cash. It's the way to go.
Chris, we got a few economic indicators this week. Anything particular stand out to you?
Mostly on the housing side, Kyle. I think that was probably the big, you know, prints for the week was mostly data on housing. We got information on housing starts, building permits, and then later in the week, you know, we saw sales data on both existing and new homes. You know, if we looked at the starts and permits, both of the headline numbers were strong. But if you split it between you know, multi-unit and single family. You know, single family for housing starts, you know, is down, you know, 2.8%. That was the third consecutive month of declines. You know, building permits, housing for single family housing, building permits were, you know, roughly flat, up 0.6%, but a big gain in multifamily units. You know, to provide a little context here, rents in, you know, the summer were up about 7.5% on multifamily units and apartments. So this growth in supply in multifamily units seems to make sense to kind of respond to the rising rents. You know, in fact, we have over 700,000 multifamily units under construction right now, which is the largest level since 1974. So if you look at that, you say, okay, a lot of this new growth in terms of permits and starts has been on the multifamily side. But obviously the bigger story this year has probably been, you know, single family homes and where prices have gone and the lack of inventory there. Again, you saw that within the existing home sales data where, you know, sales actually slid down 2%. Just about anybody you ask, they would say, well, what's happening is some buyers are just walking away from the market saying, I'm not bidding against eight other people, you know, to pay, you know, whatever that dollar amount is over list price. So there's been people, you know, balking at prices, and the lack of inventory is starting to, you know, show its face within the housing market as well.
Yeah, I think affordability has clearly been a conversation that we've had a number of times here. And so interesting, you know, you pair that with the inflation talk that we had. I think, you know, housing costs are one that's pretty poorly captured in traditional measures of price inflation. And so one more area where we need to tread cautiously. Obviously, you can only build so many houses. There's only so many places to build at any given time. And so and I think that'll be an area that we have to continue to watch. Obviously, the other thing or meaningful piece of news this week, unemployment claims, we continue to keep an eye on what the labor market looks like. What did we learn there, Chris?
Yeah, so we got another update on initial claims for unemployment insurance coming in the low 300,000 range, 335,000. We've kind of settled down. You know, we've had unemployment claims continue to drop, which has been a great sign. Through much of the summer, we were around kind of that 400,000 range, for much of the summer. So we have seen some improvement there. So that bears something watching. Obviously, we've talked in the past about the roll-off of the expanded unemployment benefit and what effect that might have on the labor market going forward. You know, this most recent reading again showed some strength in the labor market of people returning to work.
Yeah, thank you for that, Chris. Well, thank you for listening. We enjoy doing the program for you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.